Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, René van der Blist. He's a guide at the Arnhem Bridge Museum. And I was over there for the commemorations this year in September of the battle in the Second World War. Followed by Rob van der Zon. He's from Oosterbeek, which is on the outskirts of Arnhem too. And he's an artist, also talking about his ideas about the battle and the commemorations that go on every year and grow every year about the battle in Arnhem. And finally, Mark Windows from Windows on the World podcast. He talks about the secret corporate plan to sterilise our cities into virtual people farms in the next 10 or 15 years. It sounds impossible, but Mark could be right, and he's been in Bristol to talk to people about it. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you've got a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
I'm René van der Blist. I'm a volunteer here at the Airborne at the Bridge. Airborne at the Bridge is part of the Airborne Museum in Hartenstein. And we, on this location, we tell the stories about three guys, a German officer, an English officer and a Dutch civilian, all being shot here at the bridge during the battle for Arnhem, and all being highly decorated. The British officer was Greyburn. He got the Victoria Cross for his action here on the side of the bridge.
Okay, why was it so significant that the British were here at the bridge? Because they were really surrounded by Germans. They couldn't affect the battle, surely.
That's correct. This bridge was occupied by approximately 750 paratroopers. A few kilometers to the west, there were 12,500 paratroopers being dropped. So only a small part of it could occupy this bridge. But the second plan was that maybe if they could hold the city of Oosterbeek, a few kilometers to the west, maybe 30 corps could cross this River Rhine and then get into Germany.
Now, the British who were at the bridge here, could they actually stop the Germans using the bridge? Were they able to stop them using it?
They could hold the Germans for a few days. They occupied the bridge from Sunday till Thursday, and at that time it was impossible for the Germans to reinforce their troops south of the Rhine. So that was part of the British paratroopers being here at the bridge.
What was the legacy, do you think, for the Dutch civilians and the community here after the war? Because I would have thought that it was a failure, really, and the battle was a failure. So the Dutch might not be too happy about the English coming back to commemorate the battle.
That's quite the contrary, because the Dutch civil population here, they had 9 days of fighting together with the British paratroopers in their own house. So there was really a bond between the Dutch civil population and the British paratroopers. Well, that was born during those days.
What about the actual effect of the battle? Because it did mean that Arnhem and parts of the land to the south of the River Rhine here, the Neder Rhine, were still in German hands. And I imagine that the Germans didn't deal too good with the civilians.
That's correct. After the battle, big parts of Arnhem were evacuated. All the people had to leave their houses. After the liberation in May 1945, the Dutch population came back and found their houses completely destroyed and completely robbed by the Germans. Still, there is a bond between the Dutch and the British. Being the British here, fighting for their lives and fighting for the freedom of Holland, despite the fact that they did not succeed in their actions. But there are still a lot of respect, even today, for those veterans and for the people fighting in those days.
What about Germans? Do they come and visit the museum here?
Yes, still there are coming German tourists now to Arnhem. And when they come into our museum, the first thing that we see is that they don't speak German, but they speak English. After we have told them that they could speak German, most of the people are very sorry about what had happened, and they feel ashamed about being a German, and the fact that the Germans were treated the Dutch people in that way as they used to.
What do you think is the lesson today for what happened here? Because that we now would hope, after the Second World War, everybody hoped that this would bring an end to this kind of conflict. But right now, in places like the Middle East, in Ukraine, conflicts are brewing again, aren't they?
Yes, I think as long as there are people walking around on this globe, I think there will still be a war or a dispute. I don't think people will learn from the past, unfortunately.
Well, we'll try and do something about that. But also, why is it, do you think, that there's still such an interest in this particular battle? Because there's lots of battles before all over Europe. When the Nazis took over Europe, occupied Europe, and when it was liberated by the Russians and liberated by the British and the Americans. So why this battle? Why is it so important, do you think, today?
Well, I think part of it is that Arnhem and Oosterbeek were very quiet cities, about 100 kilometers from the front line. And from one day until the other, we were in the middle of the battle. The houses were occupied by Germans, by paratroopers from the UK. All of a sudden, we were in the middle of the battle, and I think that the cheerful chaps, as my father used to call the paratroopers, despite all the fightings, are still, for us, to our imagination. It must have been wonderful chaps there fighting for our freedom in a foreign country for them.
What about your own house? You are from Arnhem here. Was there any fighting in your house?
Well, I wasn't born at that time, but the house my parents lived in was in Oosterbeek, in the Mariaweg. And it was occupied partly by the 21st Independent Parachute Company. And later it was occupied by the Germans. And after the war, my parents found the house partly destroyed, but totally robbed.
And for anyone from the UK or anywhere else that's visiting this part of the world, can you just tell us a bit about how to find your museum here?
It's very easy to find. If you go to Arnhem, you find the main bridge, which has been such a vital role during those days. And our museum is a few hundred meters from that bridge. And the main museum, Hartenstein, is in the former headquarters of the British 1st Airborne Division in Oosterbeek.
What happens here every year?
Every September we commemorate all the veterans here. The festivities are getting larger and bigger. And today there's a big concert here, a liberation concert. On Saturday we have a mass parachute droppings with more than 1,000 paratroopers being dropped by Hercules aircraft. There is a commemoration service at the Airborne Cemetery on Sunday, which is very much visited by the Dutch people, and the school children here in Arnhem and Oosterbeek are laying flowers at every grave. No one is forgotten there.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Rob van der Zon. I was born in 1958, so 13 years after the war. I grew up as a boy in this village, Oosterbeek, with the topic of the Battle of Arnhem, the Slag om Arnhem, as they called it. Almost every day at tea time, coffee break, whatever, because that was still very vivid memory that most people had, which were through horrendous times with a lot of agony, a lot of houses burning down, a lot of demolition, conflicts with Germans, of course, because there haven't been too much Germans here during the war, but in 1944 it all intensified. Therefore, my interest in the wartime history of this village got started. I never was a real collector like my friends were those times, collecting all sorts of goods from the war, varied from gun shells, gun parts, rusty helmets and what have you, uniform parts, anything. I kept myself away from that a little bit, though I started restoring motorcycles from that era, like BSA, because I was a BSA addict. Yeah, and then later I got more and more into the factual history of the battle.
Oosterbeek was called after the war the Witch's Cauldron during the war, because the British were surrounded here and were fighting for several days to survive against quite overwhelming odds.
Now, what the thing that I noticed, that the German resistance was overwhelming, well organized in the end, certainly, in the beginning, in the first hours of the landings on the 17th of September, on a Sunday, a very beautiful, shiny Sunday, of course, the Germans had to figure out what was happening. And later on, they got the idea of what the purpose was of the landings. Was the Arnhem Bridge. And then they got organized as well as Germans can. That's the best habit probably they have in organizing, getting structure into things. And then they recaptured themselves and commenced the battle against the English. And the fact that the air landing troops were always very lightly armed, so you can bring panzer stuff with you through the air, only perhaps a brand carrier or whatever. That's all you can bring by hammer cars or horse or gliders. But still, with that in mind, with the amount, with a limited amount of people, they held on for 9 days under horrifying condition. So there's lack of food, lack of ammunition.
Lack of water, yeah.
Water.
The Germans cut the water supply.
Yeah, and they drank water out of the heating systems in the houses as when they had, and that water was polluted with all, everything. You shouldn't drink that. Probably a lot got sick. But still, the major part of the divisions fought on for 9 days, and they were still not really defeated in the morality. Materially, they were defeated because there was lack of everything, food and ammunition, and like I said, water. But the mentality was never beaten. And there were very good troops against the Germans who showed to be very good soldiers when you look at the First World War and how they advanced in the early days of 1940 throughout Europe. And still, these guys, these Red Berets, were able to not giving in.
What about the interactions with the civilians? Did the civilians at the time keep well away from the battle? I would imagine they wouldn't want to get anywhere near it.
Now, they were hiding in the cellars. They were hiding, but was still in the act. They were still a part of the decor, but they have to live through it in the relative safety of the cellars. But they could hear the walls fall. They could hear the pattering sounds of the burning houses. Everything was a total chaos. So there was a lot of fear, and people got shot because they got out of the cellar too early and get hit by a sniper or a stray bullet or whatever. But finally, when it was ended, the backdraw of it all was, instead of the liberation which was hoped for by many people, turned into a nightmare, meaning that the major part of the possessions were destroyed. or burnt or whatever, and they had to flee. They had to escape. They had to pack their stuff and had 48 hours to leave the homestead and then find another place, wherever that might be.
Did people manage to survive? Any people that stayed here?
Yeah, the Germans was plundering the houses, and they gave the authority the permission to the collaborators to do the same. So every house was being scavenged of any worthy valuable goods, paintings, pianos, furniture, everything. Or it was demolished out of some sort of hate against the collaborators with the English, because the Germans hoped that the Dutch population would finally at last join them or be more sympathetic towards them, but which never happened. The people who stayed, although the Germans had a decree that people had to leave, they were doing that sneakily, so without being seen. But in the end, they will find out that some people still living there, and they were also forced to get away.
So for the Dutch population after the war, did they blame the British? Because it must be very difficult to see the British arrive here and then the British actually make things worse for the population, in fact.
That's a miracle which happened in the early days. Now, let's say 1946, just after the war, when shyly the British survivors came back to Oosterbeek to see what was left of their camp comrades that was randomly buried everywhere, that there had been a relocation of the corpses being reburied at the Airborne Kerkhof, and that they thought everybody will hate us because we have been the big disturbers here, which the Germans reacted upon, and now they got the whole village partly demolished. But the opposite happened. And people were glad that they were back and they were welcomed. And that was quite shocking for them to see that there was no bitterness or no hate or whatever towards the British, that there was also a cause for demolishing a part of the village. But instead, they were welcomed, and they were welcome at home again as they were in 1944.
Well, there's something strange about the Battle of Arnhem, because most battles over time get forgotten, less remembered. This battle in Arnhem and Nijmegen, every year is a bigger commemoration for it. Why is that?
Yeah, that's very weird. Something which I don't understand, because it's getting more and more of a folklore party every year. That's something which I don't agree with, because every year there is the so-called Airborne Wandertocht. It's a march. In the first years after the war, it was organized to collect money to have the people, the family, the parents of the guys who died here, to have them over to the Netherlands so they could visit their graves. It was all very, with a lot of dignity, and it was not a party. It was not a happy thing. And now it's turned into a jolly, cheerful rendezvous with people who like to drink and be loud or whatever, without realizing what the original idea was behind the march. In that sense, I see a lot of commemoration with having to do with the war turning into a happy blah-blah drinking party. And I don't absolutely not agree with that movement. And there's another thing involved, and that is the glorification of war and the need for a NATO and the need for to get to be armed and to have the knife between you in the jaw ready for action. But that's American influence, which is as a disease spreading all over Europe. Young people who don't have too much information from the parents, and they go fully within that idea, and that's wrong.
It's almost like as the generation that remembers this battle is dying, there's a kind of new mythology is being created around it that doesn't bear much relevance to the experience of those who lived through it.
The ones who lived through it, no, completely different. But the youngsters, they are too far away from the reality. Therefore, I used to have a banner across the street saying, "There's no glory in battle," and there is no glory in battle. You cannot die with a smile on your face and be proud to die with a bullet or your arm ripped off. That's bloody nonsense. There is no glory. There's no glory in pain. There's no glory serving a leader which has to be served because it's king and country or whatever. Total shit.
But is there no glory in defeating the Nazis? I mean, they were pretty dangerous occupiers of Europe, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. They were, certainly were. And they were very fanatical. And it has to be stopped, of course. But if you know a little bit more about the history of how Hitler came to power and all the forces that were behind it, you find out it is very weird that even the Americans contributed in funding the Nazis with the help of the Dutch Prince Bernhard and the Amsterdam Koophandel Bank, which directed the money to the Nuremberg Bank. And even during the war in 1943, a main figure in the plan, called Mr. Henry Ford, got tapped on the shoulder and later on was fined because of the Trading with the Enemy Act, which he did. That's something which you shouldn't forget. And there's much more to the story. And I do believe that the principle, the basic idea of the Germans bringing a new structure to Europe, that's not the good structure, but it was a structure which is better than the structure today. Today, people are in some sort of material well-being, but morally, it's sliding more and more into a sort of nothingness.
In this place where you are in Oosterbeek,
this was definitely part of the perimeter, because this road, Weverstraat, curves down, and it goes directly to the old church, which was the last stand of Mr. Lonsdale, as you probably know. From there, they flew over the Rhine in the night of the 25th on to the 26th. Some 2,300 managed to swim across the Rhine or be brought across the Rhine by boats held by the Canadians.
What about the meetings that started 10 years after the battle, the Bilderberg conferences?
I personally believe I knew about the Bilderbergers before I did a very funny discovery. The discovery I made was through a journey I made with people who wanted to bring or propagate the idea of peace, being connected, and freedom in a broader sense. I walked all the way from northeast of the Netherlands in a place called Wedde in Groningen, through some spots in Germany. That's a second country, so I got connected with. And then I made it the most southern point of the V. That's the form of the route I made in Belgium. And from there on, the course was northwesterly towards the northwest point of the Netherlands in Noord-Holland. During that journey, I met some very peculiar people, as if it was made to meet very peculiar people, because the purpose was very peculiar. I did it with a cart and a horse, and I did it most of the time by foot. I never went onto the cart to be more comfortable, but if the horse had to walk, I will walk as well. At some point in Drenthe, I met a woman who was specialized in gemstones. And for every condition you could use for healing or whatever, gemstones, but I'm not so much into that. But she said, I do sympathize with the idea so much. From all the stones I brought along, you can all have a choice, because I was with more people. I was the last one to choose, so the last one, which was the biggest stone that was left on the table, therefore I naturally got it. And that stone was a long oblonged crystal, which was put into a sack with all the other crystals, which was carried along all the journey from begin till the end. So it was in some way soaked with the energy of peace, connectedness and freedom. So when I got home and I sold the cart and I brought the borrowed horse back to the stable it came from, I still thanked these people. I thought, what should I do with a crystal? What is the purpose of it? So one Sunday afternoon I thought, well, in terms of an adventure book for young boys, I thought, well, this stone means something and it wants to tell me something, so I have to go look for it. So I put it in my pocket and then I took a walk through Oosterbeek. I got it out of my pocket every time I encountered a church steeple or a big a narrow high tree or anything which could resemble the form of the crystal. And I couldn't find a connection with which would say something like, yeah, that there's a connection here, this is telling, one is telling one of the other. And then I came in the neighborhood of the vicinity of the museum here in Oosterbeek, the Airborne Museum. I looked around and I saw the memorial that was erected there to commemorate the Battle of Arnhem. And I took the stone out of my pocket once again. And I held it upwards with a big obelisk in the background. And I thought, bingo, I got you. This is the one that stone is sending me to. And in a flash, I could understand the idea behind that, not only that obelisk, but the market garden itself. And a name flashed into my mind, telling me, you are not the woman keeper of home and safety and the warm spot called home, carrying the pigeon on your arm, having a sign of the cross clamped between your thighs, but because that is blasphemy in the sense of religion, of Christian religion. A woman never has, in any form, any time, in any depiction or statue, painting or whatever, held a cross, sign of the cross, between her legs. Never. If there's a cross present, it will always be in the background, much more higher up, and not in contact with the woman itself. And then she has that pigeon on the arm. And a pigeon is what has been described as a colomba. It's a sacrificial animal, traditionally. And then I thought, well, sacrificing Diana, which I later found out it was another name for Semiramis. That's the foundress of the city-state of Babylon. And I thought, well, what is Babylonian around here? That's the bloody Bilderberg Hotel. And then a sort of avalanche started in my consciousness, in my awareness about history and everything that was around the Battle of Arnhem. It was a blood sacrifice of Babylonian origin. And the market garden is not just an explanation of the land operations, 30 corps, and the guys from the air. A market garden is a garden which you grow food in, and what is the surplus you trade it with the other people who have garden, and carrots and cabbage and what have you in your garden. It has to do with yield and trade, commerce, that is money, coins, that is. So the blood sacrifice was needed to make a transformation from human life, good intentions to save, to solve problems. In that sense, it was the Nazism, and turn it into a commercial thing. The big red thread in that story is Mr. Burnett, because he knew what was going on. He was part of the Irene Brigade, as it's called, the brigade, and he was Nazi all the way. Because he played a double role, and he managed in some way, which I have my own ideas about, which is King Kong, that the Germans were instructed, and the final piece of the puzzle they got from certain figures, and then they 100% knew what the operation was meant for. And that had to be blocked, and all these guys had to be put on the altar and give their blood to the idea of the Babylonian thought, which was later in 1954 turned into the Bilderbergers. And the whole European idea, if you see the symbols and the mythology and the architecture even, it has everything to do with Babylonian. And the Babylonian Satanism in that still exists. And the European Union has a blood background. Even the obelisk itself is a very ancient sign of force, power, a power, a spot which contains power, which have been sacrificed by ritually enforced by a certain ritual, according to the Babylonian traditions. The Germans must have called it the Hexenkessel, and the witch's cauldron, of course, the English, but Hexenkessel is the Dutch word. Marked garden, destined to fail, because I do believe that it's destined to fail. They did everything to make it go wrong, from the denial of the intelligence and the Dutch, from the Dutch resistance, to the wrong crystals in the communication machines they had.
So what was the relationship with the Dutch resistance then? Because, I mean, potentially the Dutch resistance would have been crucial in a battle like that.
Yeah. There was a big station here, not far from here, who had very a major role in a tea garden thing that was going on with the Diogenes bunker in the vicinity of Delen. After they received the message from the Germans, and they re-transmitted it to England to inform them about the situation here. The information was collected by the underground organization, which was collecting all the evidence and the photos they could make from the presence of the armored cars and the armored SS divisions that were brought here. But it's not logic to have the troops from the Falaise Gap or whatever, which had to be had to recover and recuperate to bring them to the woods of Wolfhese, while they could better be at the Delen German station, because there were garages there, hospitals, and whatever, all you need for people to recuperate. No, they were brought into the heath to lie around there with a stick of grass in their mouth to hear the lark sing. No, that's not complete nonsense. They knew there was something going on, and which was they had to be there in that neighborhood.
Some people say they were close to the road north of Arnhem, so it was easy to get to the road and straight into the town. The German.
Yeah.
Is that true?
That's true, very true, because there were not too many concrete roads those days, but there's one big concrete road which goes directly to the center of Arnhem. So they knew that that structure was would also be used by the English, of course.
What about the route between here and Nijmegen? Because we had hundreds of tanks in Nijmegen, and everyone has pointed out that the tanks should have made it here to Arnhem.
That's the most questionable thing in the whole battle. I wrote the route from Leopoldsburg, Belgium, where the original 30 Corps started, and I did it on my BZ M20 motorcycle from 1941, together with a lot of other collectioners with the tanks and what have you. And we did the original route, and if you see how much it will cost for in nowadays, in peacetime, to get through all these villages and arrive finally at Nijmegen, and then take the last bit of road, some 20 kilometers to the south side of the Arnhem Bridge, is not too easy. And everybody knows that it took too much time to get to the south part of the Bridge of Arnhem. But they still had air superiority, and they could easily wipe out the German machine gun nests and artillery stands from the air. And they came all the way from Belgium, and then they stopped when they saw the bridge and the boys were dying on the other side of the river. It's a bloody shame. And I still don't understand why that. There must be some sort of force majeure that said, no, let him die over there. It's done for. We give it another winter, and then we'll see, because the Americans had to liberate Berlin.
They didn't have enough fuel, they didn't have enough ammunition, it was dark, they might lose their way, or lots of things, not enough infantry. Do you buy any of that?
No. They had probably had, we have just brewed nice warm tea, so why go on? It's very unlogic.
So why do you explain it? How do you explain it? How did people here explain it?
People don't understand, but they don't know what I know, what the people who want to dig in deeper into the story. And if you dig deeper in the story and connect all the dots, there is something fishy about it. Something is not right, and something had to go wrong, because the Americans did a good task at Nijmegen, like they still did at Somme, whatever. The American soldiers, that is. I'm not talking about American Supreme Command, but the individual guy, the GI, did a good job, as well as the English did. But the command structure of the 30 Corps was bollocks. It was absolute bollocks, because they stopped at the point at which they should push on, regardless of the victims, of the cost that may give with the presence of the German artillery, because with the aid of the air force, they could have probably made it on the bridge and helped these guys on the north side of the Rhine. And it would have turned into a complete other story. At least what they could have done is liberate a part of these guys that were closed in at the bridge in Arnhem. Support them with a cover fire to retreat across the bridge and not get caught in at a POW or get shot or whatever. Because there's not... Yeah, John Frost and his team was thinned out very much, and because they had lack of anything. They had no ammunition, no nothing. They had to give up.
Well, apparently he was angry. Frost was actually really angry about the lack of the tanks.
Yeah, that's right. Same as Minister Sosabowski, Stanislaw Sosabowski. He had every right to be angry, because he was counting on a very vital part in the battle by the Polish troops, And then in order to be present and to get something in return, he might sort of thinking that the battle would go on for to free Poland. But the Stalin Churchill Roosevelt pact already chopped Europe in parts, in slices, and had decided what was going to be Mr. Stalin's deal, and Poland was not involved in that.
Well, look, it certainly is a can of worms, this whole battle. For anyone thinking of visiting Arnhem for one of these commemorations in the future, is there anywhere you'd recommend that they come to where they can get a more true picture of what happened?
Not at the places where the official story has been told, because it's full of lies, full of half-truths. And half-true things are as good as a lie. As same as the 9/11 books which they try to sell everywhere. You have to go to the alternative view of the situation. You find them here at at this chair here. Yeah. I only know a small, very small part of it, but I know my thing, and I do believe that I'm on the right track.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm Mark Windows, and I do a weekly internet radio show, which is also an occasional TV show, at windowsontheworld.net. And my background is in research on esoteric subjects. And about 10 years ago, I started looking into the system of law and how things affect us and what we can do about it. This led me into looking at local authorities and especially corruption that was going on. And then I started looking at the bigger picture, and that's the title of the talk, which is this Saturday at the Arc Centre in Bristol, which features myself, Piers Corbyn and Sandy Adams. And it's about the bigger picture of what's affecting everyone in the country. Really, it's about global local governance.
So what do you mean by that?
Well, the Global Action Plan implemented at a local level came out of the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. And what we do with these talks is put things into...
Is that Agenda 21?
Yes, that's right, yeah. It's Agenda 21, but what's interesting is that a lot of people in local authorities will say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. For instance, I wrote to Councillor Clyde Lokes in Waltham Forest, where I used to live, and he's the cabinet member of the environment, who's part of the implementation of a thing called Mini Holland. Three London boroughs were brought into this thing called Mini Holland. And basically, it's about closing roads off, and it's all about sustainable development, Agenda 21. Now, he wrote back to me and said, thank you for your email. However, as I don't subscribe to the hugely discredited conspiracy theory of an Agenda 21 takeover of the world, I found it of no importance and use whatsoever. However, the actual show that I sent him was featuring people like Gordon Peters, who took down the Haringey development vehicle in the courts, and also housing officers from places like Hackney. And this is the sort of response that you get. You get this kind of weird Stonewall response. But really what we're talking about here is just a management concept. Agenda 21 is a management concept brought from a global level to local level. And it sounds like a massive thing when people start talking about it. But if you can just think of it as a kind of management concept of every resource on the planet, that's exactly what it is. And it ties into the regeneration that's going on. We've done loads of stuff on this and how accountability is being taken away from the public at a local level.
I mean, surely, Mark, what's really going on is that local governments are just being cut back. And because there's less and less money coming to local government from central government, it just simply means that local government has got less and less power and the local businesses have got more and more power. And that's actually fueling this agenda, surely.
No, not at all. In actual fact, it's the opposite way around. What you'll find is that local businesses are not supported at all, but there is actually an appearance of support for business. Now, this is where it starts to get into this bigger picture, the bigger picture of what it's really about, because what we have is a huge amount of people who've been mentored into this Agenda 21 program. Now, it's not something.
What do you mean when you say mentored into it? What do you mean when you say mentored into it?
Well, there's change agents that are being trained in the public and the private sector. I've been looking at this for 10 years. And I'm able now to map out exactly what's going to happen in an area when regeneration takes place. And I've been down to meetings with Piers Corbyn, who's a housing activist, has been for a long time, and also challenges the anthropological global warming agenda, which is a huge part of this. And we deal with that in the shows. But really, what we're talking about here is the way that council meetings and councils operate. They are being removed from the public. We have a thing which is called Delphi technique. Now, this might sound totally alien to people, but every public meeting in this country is controlled by Delphi technique with trained facilitators. These aren't people who work for the council. They're employed by the council. And what they're there to do is gain group consensus. Now, consensus doesn't mean everyone agrees. It means everyone appears to agree. And that's what I've been pointing out for a very long time. And I've found that looking into even things like the Occupy movement, this is where I first came into looking at Delphi technique. General assemblies were created all over the world with facilitators and co-facilitators, splitting people up into groups, dividing and ruling them, and using subversive techniques against them. These techniques are being used against the public all the time, and there are gatekeepers at every level in every part of governance
so
in this country.
So who's doing this to people, why, and who's funding it?
Well, as I said to start with, Tony, if you look at it as a management concept, if you want to control and manage resources and population, you need a plan. And that plan is now global and has been for quite a long time. And for instance, people can look at things like the Habitat conferences every year, every 2 years, actually. They're biennial now. But they dictate housing policy. Now, all this high-density housing that's being introduced into areas. I mean, I've seen London and areas of London, so-called regeneration areas, have changed completely within 3 years. They've changed out of all recognition to what they were. And say I lived in a borough called Waltham Forest. It didn't change for 25 years. How come in 3 years, all the infrastructure changed? 70 roads closed with no public consultation. People saying we didn't vote for this. And nobody seems to be able to know where it came from or what can be done about it. So basically, we're giving people the tools to look at this. And it's not actually that complicated. And once you look at it as a system, it makes complete sense. But if you can't see it as for what it is, then it's incredibly difficult to understand and it starts to look a bit mind-blowing. And that's what I want to do with this talk. We've got all the quotes and all of the documents that people can look at. And we've now got people all over the country sending us documents which prove that this is what's going on in local councils. So councils are now becoming these mega regions. In other words, lots of local authorities are joining together. Just look that up. What this is about is public consultation is being removed. And that's what these talks are about. And basically what you can do to take back some kind of power locally. And we are actually having some success with this.
Where and when can people see what you're up to, Mark?
Well, we're at the ARC Centre in Bristol on Saturday, the 6th of October. And it's from midday. It's going to be myself and Piers Corbyn. We talk about the housing, the regeneration that's going on all over the country, the background to that. And then we go into the bigger picture of the Global Action Plan, which is affecting everybody locally. And we have Sandy Adams as well talking about the background and the implementation of Agenda 21. And all this is actually from a perspective of people who've done lots of research on it. So we've actually got the documentation and everything. So, yeah, we're in Bristol on Saturday. It's windowsontheworld.net. We're going to be there all day from 12 a.m.
And if no one does anything, what's Bristol going to look like in 20 years' time?
Well, that's a really good question, because with the rollout of 5G and what's going on with the Internet of Things, my word would probably be dystopia, because that's what I see being rolled out now. The way places are changing, especially in cities, is, to me, draconian. It's a corporate takeover of everything. So I would say that we're just going to see very sterile places with no individuality and a completely controlled and managed population with no private transport, and being put into these high density housing places where people are monitored and surveilled 24 hours a day.
Mark Windows, thanks very much for joining us. That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, René van der Vlist from the Bridge Museum in Arnhem, and artist Rob van der Zon from Oosterbeek. Also Mark Windows from windowsontheworld.net. Also to studio engineers Joss Chivers and Dave Bazenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to the PRSC Arts Centre on 0117 909 6897. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the national volunteering website do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my 2-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. on BCFM 93.2. Meanwhile, till the same time next week, here on Dialect, goodbye for now.
Oh, Bye. This has been a really nice session, I think. First session we've ever had from Black Dog. Should be about on our fourth or fifth by now, I'd say. Psycho Sign is the title of the track.